This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, Kay Byer was North Carolina's poet laureate, but we consider our next guest the poet laureate of The State of Things. Jeffrey Beam is a prolific writer. His latest project called The Broken Flower. Jeffrey calls these poems an epiphany, and he joins me in the studio now to tell us more. Jeffrey, welcome back. So good
to
have you.
Frank. Thanks for having me again.
Tell us about the poems in this book. Where do they come from, and what do you mean by epiphany?
This book, is, in a way, is a sister book to an earlier volume, one of my earliest books called The Fountain. And these poems actually began as I closed out The Fountain. During the time I was writing this book, I was also, towards the latter half of it, writing a book of very minimalist poems that we've talked about on the show called Gospel Earth. Gospel Earth was a book in which I attempted to create, in a way, a sacred text, a new Gnostic gospel is what I like to call it. They were very short, small poems using sort of a gnomic or aphoristic or an Zen koan kind of approach to writing poems, many poems that were only 1 to 2 to 4 lines long. The poems in this book are sort of another mode that I write in, which are longer poems. But as you know, even my longest poems are not that long, a page and a half. In that book, Gospel Earth, I was trying to write a spiritual philosophy about my spiritual philosophy or reveal a spiritual philosophy. Whereas these poems, I call them epiphanies because they are the experience of that spiritual philosophy in the world. So true everyday occurrences in my life, trying to express that spiritual philosophy through the experience itself.
And that's a great subject of yours, this mystery of transformation, as it were, the thing that happens in the moments between the sort of spiritual aspiration and the very physical, tangible experience of life.
Yeah, it's important to me. I mean, that is my, I think my, I see my role as a poet, to try to make a relationship between the physical world and the spiritual world. I consider myself a writer of spiritual texts almost as importantly as a writer of poems or even prose text. And I'm trying to find that connection. Why are we in this material world? But how does it relate to something larger?
Poetry is really well suited to try to express that, because so I'm inclined to ask you about the spiritual world. And that would elicit from you a long-winded, perhaps,
indeed,
hand-waving explanation about God, not God, and on and on and on. But the poetry itself is a way of doing spirituality, it seems
Absolutely.
To me, if I can put it that way. So without further ado, can I ask you to read one?
Yes. This is a poem called In Lucca. Have you ever been to Lucca? It's in Tuscany. It's an amazing town, a little town that the old town is still inside of old Renaissance walls. And at night, they lock the doors and no cars are allowed inside. So we were staying there for a week. This was actually my first trip to Italy. And it was an interesting time because I was completely absorbed and transformed by the experience of Italy, which is why I've gone back and back. But my grandmother, who had been, we've talked about before, who was the person who made me a poet, my best friend when I was growing up, ended up in the hospital while we were there. And I did not know, but before we came home, she was going to die. But during that week, she entered the hospital. This poem is about what happened every afternoon during the siesta. We were there in early March, so it was getting dark pretty early in the day. So that's why the poem mentions the sunset. Every day, this is what happened. And it was like a, you know, sort of the baby blanket that comforted me as my grandmother was so ill. And as I was being just absorbing all this amazing stuff in front of me, the great art and the people who are so wonderful. In Lucca. Sweet angel, little Italian boy, whose voice rises with his mother's in the afternoon light and the old woman crooning to her cat in the courtyard shadow. The pigeons cooing, the piano melancholy from an upstairs room. This beautiful sameness greeting us each afternoon as the day descends in the churches in the old town and the Madonna, San Sebastiano, San Michele flutter above the roof tiles, their halos, arrows, wings trembling secretly. Phrases repeating over and over by the child. And the room settling into soothing monotony, and the sunset, and the sweet angel Italian child waiting impatiently for his supper to come.
In Luca, a poem in Jeffrey Beam's latest collection, The Broken Flower. Beautiful sameness, soothing monotony. We've been trained to loathe sameness and monotony.
And loathe the word beautiful in a poem, too, yeah. You know? And that was the epiphany, that this sort of repetitive every day in this little village, how many centuries had this same thing been going on in this little town? It was so comforting. It was just the most beautiful, embracing sort of experience.
Is this one of those towns where they sort of really literally sort of draw up the drawbridge and the traffic
stops at
night?
They really do. I mean, the gate where the cars come through into the town during the day is locked. It is pulled shut. There is a doorway where people can enter the old town, but no vehicles.
So you find yourself in a kind of a monastic condition where the natural rhythms of life actually dictate your senses, your experience, which we're not at all a part of. We resist every bit of those natural rhythms. What does that do to us, Jeffrey?
Well, just think how much noise is in and sound is in our lives all the time. So few of us now go anywhere without a headset on, or the radio on in the car, or at home the TV on all the time, or the radio, or whatever. There is no silence in the world that we live in, and you have to absolutely make it, because there's so much that is being expressed from the world to you if you get quiet and listen. And that's one of the things I attempt to do as a poet, is to find those places that we don't listen to or look in or see or feel.
Do those places, does that spiritual world that you describe in your poetry, is it something that you've had to train yourself to hear, or does it just break in on you and grab you by the collar and say, slow down, Jeffrey, listen to this?
Well, I think more and more as the world has become noisier, I've had to work a little harder. But I was lucky as a child. It was a place I loved to live. So I spent a lot of time by myself as a child, partly to escape some dysfunction in the family, but I ended up wandering the woods a lot as a child, sitting up in trees, which is where I wrote some of my first poems, up in the tops of trees. I would go climb up into trees to read.
Forgive me for interrupting this thought, now I've got you up in the tree with your pen and your pad, and I'm thinking to myself, did anything ever surprise you? Like, now you're prepared for it. You're really listening for that surprise. But was there a moment when you were shocked at this other world coming into your life?
No. Again, I'm either insane or just very lucky. But I as a child, I used to have visions. Perhaps it's my Celtic background or the little bit of Cherokee that's in me. But the other world was always coming into me. And I was also very lucky that other world didn't overcome me. I have a brother who is schizophrenic. And I suspect that perhaps he had the same, whether it's genetic tendency or whatever, but that it did overcome him. So I always had the contrast of my brother to myself, too, that there was this great gift that was given me. And I had amazing people like my grandmother, and even my mother, who was part of the difficulty in my life, was also, being an Irish woman, she had extracurricular visions, we might call them. She was also always seeing things, and no one ever told me I was doing something wrong when I would have these visions or tell these stories that I'd heard this or saw this.
Will you read another one for us?
Sure. This one, let's do this one, The Man Who Ate Butterflies. This poem's origin is from a gift by John Menapace, the poet, who died a number of years ago. He was a good friend, and my husband and I had our 15th anniversary. We've now been together 32 years, and John had given us a box of Turkish Delight. At that time, you couldn't find Turkish Delight around here very easily, and I really fell in love with it. It's a little cube of gelatin and sugar and rose water, dusted with powdered sugar, sometimes with pistachios. And we doled out these pieces so slowly because we were enjoying them so much, and then all of a sudden they were gone. Now you can find Turkish Delight and Harris Teeter, but at the time it was not easy to find it. So I was sitting in their arboretum at UNC having lunch, which I frequently did when the days were pretty, when I was still working there, and wanting some Turkish Delight. The Man Who Ate Butterflies. You wouldn't think he would do such a thing in public, in front of children or even dogs who've been known to eat wasp, are always embarrassed. But he cannot stop himself. To imagine the sweet nectar stolen by the proboscis, the cool air between the wings, the colored dust, he thinks, Turkish delight, yum, yum. Before you know it, he has grabbed the poor thing and swallowed. He likes flowers, and so spends many afternoons visiting gardens.
Jeffrey Beam, the man who ate butterflies, from his latest collection, The Broken Flower. Jeffrey's going to be at Bullhead Bookshop on October 25th at 3:30 and Flyleaf Books on the 30th at 7 o'clock, but he is here with us now. Well, that must have startled you, the idea that you could just maybe pop that butterfly in your mouth.
That was a startling experience. I mean, that was a true epiphany that one could transform a butterfly into a taste in your mouth. Because I really felt in creating the poem, and I wrote the poem right there, that I was, although I didn't really grab the butterfly and eat it, perhaps I did, but I wouldn't admit to it, that I really could taste it. The sensation was so present that must be what eating a butterfly is like. And I love the way it sort of closes with a little bit of an ominous feel to it.
Who is this guy who visits your gardens? Keep him out of your garden. The Broken Flower. Tell us about the title.
The Broken Flower, a lot of the poems in The Broken Flower, as we've said, are epiphanies, my experience in the world of this sort of spiritual philosophy of the world. But the poems, there's a lot of brokenness in these poems. Growing up in a dysfunctional family, experiencing a lot of different kinds of losses from AIDS, for example, losing a lot of friends. There's been a lot of loss in my life, and coming to terms with that has been a bit of coming to terms with why are you in the material world. Accepting myself as a queer person and realizing that I was different from other people, even before I realized what it was, why I was different. I mean, I already knew I was different because I was having visions, and then all of a sudden I realized that I was different because I was having impulses toward people of the same sex. So I had a lot of things that seemed, as far as the world was concerned, things that weren't right, that were inappropriate or incorrect or wrong or evil, broken. And that led me to start looking at the world, at the imperfections in the world. And so this book is very much, there are a number of poems that address this brokenness. The Broken Flower is the title poem, a poem I have never wanted, which talks about the difference between perfection and striving to be perfect. A lot of poems in which this sort of fragmentary parts of the world and things that we don't look at usually are looked at with reverence and with gratitude and with the realization that's why the world is here. It's a school for spiritual learning. And if it wasn't broken, we wouldn't have anything to learn.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you have described two very different kinds of brokenness, that which the world considers broken and you need to fix it. And then, and sort of like that wonderful line in the Leonard Cohen song Anthem, everything, there's a crack in everything. That's where the light gets in. Is brokenness part of the perfect condition, in a sense? That the brokenness is where the light gets in. Without it,
brokenness is where the light comes in. And without that brokenness, one would never be able to address one's creativity. One would never be able to learn compassion toward oneself. And if you don't have compassion toward yourself, then there's no way you can have a compassion toward anyone else. So this person who I was, who had all these fragments of self and these broken pieces and these puzzle pieces that I needed to put together to finally learn who I was, without any of that, the light would have never come in. I would have never understood divinity is present in all of this. And it's the divinity that's in the presence of all of this that shines a light, as Cohen is implying, on the brokenness within, then shines back at us.
And you realize that it's, as you suggested earlier, shared.
Yes.
And that this is not anything to be hidden, because after all. There's a wonderful, right at the beginning of the book, you call it a poem of preface, and it's a quote from Jacques Maritain. Do you have it in front of you? Because if you don't, I can read it.
The Maritain quote?
The quote,
no,
yeah.
Or I
do
don't
you have it?
To.
Things are not only what they are, they ceaselessly pass beyond themselves and give more than they have. They're better and worse than themselves because being superabounds and because nothingness attracts what comes from nothingness.
I was actually thinking about that quote this morning. I must have intuited that you were going to ask about it. I almost wrote it down to bring with me that nothingness. How does it go? Nothingness attracts nothingness.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful poet, aphoristic poet, Antonio Porcia, that talks a lot about nothingness. I just finished a wonderful book by Jim Holt. Now the name has slipped my title.
We'll look it up on Amazon after this.
But yeah, it's the book about how did nothing come from nothing? That's not.
And then when
the
we find it, we're going to buy it at a local bookstore.
It's a great, a great explanation of how did something come from nothing.
Yeah.
And nothingness is the importantness that we're talking about. Not nothing.
Right.
Nothing is nothing.
Right.
But nothingness has everything in it. And if we can open ourselves, like in the silence, which one would think is nothing, but silence is not nothing. It's nothingness. And I love that quote because of that. It seemed an appropriate way to open the book.
So will you read Credo for us?
Yes. Credo is one of the small handful of poems which are sort of the thematic poems of the book, in which every poet, every writer has to write something which perhaps is a piece that is sort of declaiming, this is what I do, this is why I do it. And this is one of those poems, Credo. Now, when I talk, it is not just to say this or that, but it is to say what is between. Over there under the sycamore runs the argumentative periwinkle, the blue eye of southern spring. Over there, the whistle of chickadee and bluebird. Here swings the rightful cadence of the blues, the melancholic swarm of words thick with dribble and slang. To my own self be true, to say what is between. The periwinkle, the chickadee.
Credo is one of Jeffrey Beam's latest poems in his latest collection. It is called The Broken Flower. We'll talk about his readings in a moment. But that what is between is that's the silence.
It's that silence. It's that nothingness which is expressing itself constantly before us.
Into something. And poetry is, as I say, you sort of uniquely, and this is one of the things I think that people who think they hate poetry could find if we'd give it a chance. And the beautiful thing about your poetry, too, is that it is so concrete. The images are they're palpable. We're eating a butterfly. There are periwinkles. There's nothing ethereal about the language or the images.
Which was a hard thing for me to learn how to do because I was such a fantastic sort of child. And my first inspirations in poetry were the symbolist, the surrealist, the aesthetic movement of the late 19th, early 20th century, and the great mystic poets like Blake and Whitman. However, Blake and Whitman were very grounded, tangible writers too. But that whole surrealist thing of working in the subconscious, that's really where I was working at first. And it was only after discovering William Carlos Williams and the objectivist poets that I learned somehow, miraculously, to bring that tangible realness of the world, partly through Asian poetry too, which I think marries the spiritual and the real world in such a beautiful way, that I was able finally to retain all that sort of surrealist and symbolist sort of wildness, but at the same time tame it by bringing the actual world into it. It's real important to me. And I really want poems to be very complex and to carry a lot of meaning with very few words so that they have a tendency to be abstract. They could be very abstract, but I want them to be completely accessible to anyone, not just someone who reads poetry, but anyone off the street.
I think they are, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Jeffrey, please
thank
come
you.
Back.
Thank you very much.
Jeffrey Beam's upcoming new book, The Broken Flower, going to be at the Bull's Head Bookshop at UNC Chapel Hill on October 25th, 3:30. Going to be at Flyleaf Books October 30th at 7 o'clock, and at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham November 5th at 7 o'clock. He's going to be at the North Carolina Botanical Garden November 8th at 7. All of that, Jeffrey Beam's new book, The Broken Flower, coming up next, the music of Jason Hoover. Stay tuned.